All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is the Wednesday afternoon, March 6, 2019 session of the Portland City Council. Good afternoon, Carla. Would you please call the roll?
Good afternoon. Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Hardesty, Udaly.
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. Now we'll turn it over to legal counsel for a few rules on decorum. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Portland City Council. The City Council represents all Portlanders and means to do the city's business. The presiding officer preserves order and decorum during City Council meetings so that everyone can feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe. To participate in Council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the Council Clerk's Office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or first readings of ordinances. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. If it does not, you may be ruled out of order. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you're a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When you have 30 seconds left, a yellow light goes on. When your time is done, a red light goes on. If you are in the audience and would like to show your support for something that is said, please feel free to do a thumbs up. If you want to express that you do not support something, please feel free to do a thumbs down. Please remain seated in council chambers unless entering or exiting. If you are filming the proceedings, please do not use bright lights or disrupt the meeting. Disruptive conduct, such as shouting or interrupting testimony or council deliberations, will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being ejected for the remainder of the meeting. After being ejected, a person who fails to leave the meeting is subject to arrest for trespass. Thank you for helping your fellow Portlanders feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe.
Very good. We have one item this afternoon. Carla, could you please read it?
Item 214, amend Title 33 to update the neighborhood contact regulations.
Colleagues, today we'll hear an ordinance addressing proposed changes to Title 33 of the Portland City Code requirements for neighborhood contact pre-application process for new developments. The goal of these proposed changes is to both simplify and clarify the rules and expand the reach of notice to residences who are that are located around these particular developments. The current requirement inconsistently applies to different sizes of projects in different parts of the city, and the amount of time that it takes can often be unpredictable. The existing requirement provides information to neighborhood associations and to the folks in those associations' communications networks. The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability has worked with the development services to address this issue by incorporating physical signage at the site to provide additional information to residents. The goal here is to reach as many people in as efficient amount of time as possible and give them every opportunity to engage on the way that their neighborhood grows and changes. I'd like to invite the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff, Sarah Wright and Eric Engstrom, are here to tell us a little bit more about this. When they are done with their presentation, I know that Commissioner Fritz would like to introduce an amendment, so I'd like to give her an opportunity afterwards to talk about her amendment. And then, of course, we have Mr. Smith is here as invited testimony, and after that, we'll take everybody's public testimony who has signed up. If you have not signed up, there is a sign-up sheet right outside the door, or see Carla here at the clerk's desk, and we'll get you signed up. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is Eric Engstrom. I manage the Comprehensive and Strategic Planning Group at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And as you mentioned, with me is Sarah Wright, who is a planner with BPS and has been the project manager for this effort. We're here today to talk about the neighborhood contact requirement in the zoning code. As the mayor just mentioned, this is an existing code requirement that requires developers to contact neighborhood associations before they submit building permits in certain circumstances. A review and overhaul of this requirement was originally something we had planned to take on with the comprehensive plan related code work a few years back, but as we got into it, we decided it needed a little more involvement and discussion with the community before we could land on a proposal. And so it was separated out as a separate standalone project and is now coming to you. With the new zoning entitlements, with the new comprehensive plan, we had anticipated that there would be more applications triggering this requirement, so it seemed timely to take a look at it and consider overhauls and make it work better. As the mayor just mentioned, the objective was to clarify and simplify, as well as expand the reach, make the information more broadly available than it had been. So with that context, Sarah will talk about the details.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. And I also just want to thank, there are a lot of people in the room today who have contributed and improved the project along the way, so I want to acknowledge that. I'm Sarah Wright with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'm here to give you an overview of the Neighborhood Code Contact Code Update project. And the project record, as transmitted by the Planning and Sustainability Commission, is in the room, and to that record, the Bureau has added a list of outreach activities. So the current neighborhood contact requirement in the zoning code requires that applicants for building projects complete an outreach process before they submit their application to the city. The project does not address land use review notifications that are required part of the quasi-judicial process, and that's outside the scope of this project. This is a process in which the developer is required to make contact with the public. And it's important to note there is no obligation in the current requirement or in the proposed changes that would require the developer to actually make any changes to the project in response to feedback. It's an informal opportunity for a conversation to happen. And the goal is really to create an opportunity for the public to learn about and provide feedback on the project to the developer. So in this process, the applicant must send a certified letter to the Neighborhood Association. If the Neighborhood Association responds within 14 days of that mailing and invites the applicant to attend a meeting, the applicant must attend as long as the meeting is held within 45 days of that initial mailing. The meeting is an informal opportunity for community members to learn about the project and provide feedback to the developer. And the applicant has to submit evidence to BDS to the Bureau of Development Services when they submit for their quasi-judicial process or land or building permit that they met this requirement. So these meetings can be very productive, and sometimes applicants do revise their projects in response to the feedback. And there's an opportunity for people to learn more and also to make contacts that can be very valuable during the construction period. However, the meetings only happen when there is a neighborhood association in place that is active, has a land use chair who's able to receive the letter and respond to it in 2 weeks. In areas that don't have those elements in place or that have too much on their meeting agenda already, the meetings do not happen. The applicant gets no reply and is able to just submit their application. And even when meetings do happen, the opportunity to learn about and provide feedback on the project is limited to the people who attend the meeting, which is a very small subset of the much larger group of people who might be interested. And because of those issues, this project was initially part of the code reconciliation project, which is a kind of a housekeeping project following on the comprehensive plan, but it was pulled out to get a little bit more time and attention and be its own project. So we released a discussion draft last spring and a proposed draft in the summer, Planning and Sustainability Commission in August, and the recommended draft that's before you now was released in January 28th. The goals of the project were to broaden the reach of notice, to provide more information to more people, and also to increase the consistency and predictability of both the process itself and the thresholds for what kind of projects trigger the requirement. So these are the key elements of the proposal. All projects in most zones, so that's single family and multifamily residential, mixed use, commercial mixed use, EX, and campus zones, that are creating more than 10,000 square feet of new building would trigger the requirement. And the requirement would be to post a large on-site sign and also send an informational email or mail to the Neighborhood Association, District Coalition, and Business Association, which are currently also recipients of that letter. And if the project creates more than 25,000 square feet of new building, the applicant is responsible for ensuring that the project is presented at a public meeting. That can be done with the Neighborhood Association if that works for the developer and the Neighborhood Association, but it's the applicant's responsibility to make sure the meeting happens. So just to provide some context, projects that are something that's going to be built now might go through different processes. It may be getting built by right, so it's being built according to the zoning code rules. In that case, if it's getting just a building permit application, it would have to do the neighborhood contact before the building permit application. If the project is going through a land use review, that's a situation where there is an opportunity to provide testimony. The public is usually notified by mailed letters and also a small sign on site. That's a land use review process that's separate from neighborhood contact. The proposal would require that the neighborhood contact take place before the building permit is submitted or the land use review permit application is submitted, whichever comes first. Currently, projects that are going through a land use review process are then exempted from neighborhood contact, as we're proposing to remove that exemption. So you would have to do the neighborhood contact process before the land use review application or the building permit application. And I just want to note that there are different decision makers in these different processes. With neighborhood contact, the decision maker is the applicant themselves. They can decide whether to respond to feedback. For a land use review process, there's like a city hearings officer or a design commission or another decision maker like that, an opportunity to provide testimony. So this is a draft template for the sign that would be required to be posted on site. The Bureau of Development Services has developed this template, and they will continue to work on it and finalize it and post it on their website for use for developers. And you can see there is a meeting information, that yellow square. There's a space for the information about a meeting, if it's required, to be posted in that space. You can also see there's the contact information for the applicant. And then underneath, there's contact information for the Bureau of Development Services, for the District Coalition, and the Neighborhood Association. We do anticipate that these signs would generate some calls to those entities, for sure.
Can you keep this up for a second? I have a question. In the Bureau of Environmental Services, when we do community outreach, like Tabor to the River is a good example, we find that it's very beneficial to have a single point of contact.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be Debbie, you know, one of our community outreach people. And in all the communications, written and electronic, it says if you have a concern, call Debbie or email Debbie. So you have a person. And what it does is puts a human face. It also ensures accountability, that there's someone. Here, what you have is general zoning information, Bureau of Development Services. I like the fact that the applicant is personalized, but did you give some thought to having someone more specific at BDS be the person that people could get information from?
Yeah, so what's on this sign is a really tricky balance because, as you say, a sign works best if it's clear who to reach out to. With this sign, however, this is being posted by the applicant themselves, and it's before the city even knows about the project.
I see.
So we're requiring that the applicant put contact information on the sign, but the jurisdiction of the city or its ability to enforce, like the developer answering the phone or answering those emails, is limited. We wanted to make sure that people had other avenues to ask questions so they can call BDS, like about what is allowed on this site, that kind of question. And the reason the phone number that's on there is the planning and zoning hotline, so they'd be able to answer questions about what's allowed on that site. And we also wanted to make sure that people were aware of resources like the District Coalition and the Neighborhood Association. So it's a little bit of a balancing act in that it would be ideal if there was a point of contact, but because the city isn't controlling that point of contact, we wanted to make sure that people have resources.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Could I ask you a question? And I probably should know the answer to this already. Down at the bottom, if you can't read English as your first language, what actually happens if I'm calling and I speak a different language? Does somebody have a copy of this sign, or how does that work?
So what you call with that information is the planning and zoning hotline. And the reason for that is that the city has the resources to be able to get on-demand phone interpretation, whereas a developer, you know, they could be developing just one project once. They're not going to have those resources. So we wanted to make sure that they'd be able to at least call somebody who could help them understand what the sign is about.
Okay, so if I call and I say I'm standing in front of 3467 Southeast Main Street, can you tell me what this sign is all about? Will somebody actually be able to do that?
They'll be able to say, we have no idea about the sign. That's not in our systems. But they'll say, this is we know about that kind of sign. That's a sign that we do require, and we can tell you what can be built on this site.
Is there some way to database? I mean, I don't want to overcomplicate this, and I don't know how many calls they would typically get, but I'm just wondering if there's some way to database it or make it more accessible to whoever is actually answering the phone. Because I can imagine somebody might be frustrated just from a customer service perspective to be directed to a number where somebody tells them in their own language, I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the tensions of this whole requirement is that it is kind of out in this it's not inside the city's jurisdiction, so it's one of the balancing acts with this. However, there is a requirement in the proposal for the Bureau of Development Services to be posting information online, And part of what we're doing with this project is creating a tool that will allow developers to submit through a web form the information that will go on the sign, and that will be in an online map. So the staff will actually be able to see that. They will be able to look that up. They won't, again, know anything else.
Okay.
In the big picture, that is the long-term intent when we have notices like this, to eventually have a system where all these kinds of signs, you can find a virtual version of the same information online.
Cool. Thank you.
And just to clarify, this sign template is not being finalized today. The Bureau of Development Services will continue to work on that.
How big is the sign? I'm sorry.
5 feet by 4 feet.
5 by 4. Thank you.
Big. So I just want to compare a couple of elements of the current requirements to the proposed requirements. So right now, there's a certified or registered letter must be sent to the Neighborhood Association. We're replacing that with an informational letter or email and a sign summarizing the project. The recipients of the project, of the contact for the letter, remain the same, and then the sign, of course, can be seen by anybody passing by. The method of initial contact, certified mail, we're proposing to replace that with email or mail because we've been given to understand that email is much easier to process. And we really wanted to broaden the recipients of contact and make sure that information is available to the general public. So the meeting, this project also impacts the way that these meetings unfold. Currently, it's up to the Neighborhood Association, if there is a functioning Neighborhood Association, to decide if they want to put the development project on their agenda. The proposed change makes the applicant responsible for making sure there's a meeting and advertising it on the sign. The supporting materials do encourage applicants to reach out to the Neighborhood Association to ask them to host or co-host the presentation at their meeting, and we expect that applicants will generally prefer to do that since it would be a lot easier for them than trying to host their own meeting. The meeting must take place in the time period at least 2 weeks after the sign is posted and letters mailed and at least 2 weeks before the application is submitted. So just to compare the current process and the timeline and the proposed process, now after the applicant puts that letter in the mail, they have to wait 14 days, and if they don't hear back, they can go ahead and submit their application. They may have to wait up to 45 days in order to attend the meeting if required. So the timing is unpredictable between 14 and 45 days. For the proposal, it would set a predictable period of 35 days from posting and mailing the notice to the submission of the application. So regardless of the size of the proposal, regardless of whether the Neighborhood Association is active, the applicant will know that there's a 35-day wait after the sign goes up and the email or letter goes out.
Keep that slide for a sec, will you? Mm-hmm. We're at the bottom right where it says apply for land use review or building permit.
Mm-hmm.
Does the application have to include a copy of the letter or the email?
It does. There's a list of submittal requirements in the proposed code. So you have to show, you have to submit sort of an affidavit or just a statement saying that you did all the things and provide some evidence, like a copy of the email, a photo of the sign.
And I'm all for emails, but I will tell you that it is remarkable how often people send things to the wrong email address or mm-hmm. delete a part of the email address, so it goes out into the wherever.
Yeah.
I'm pleased that as part of the application, you have to put that in, because if a neighborhood association later or a business association has a grievance, they can go see where was this actually sent.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely been an important part of making sure that evidence is submitted. So we're proposing changes, as I said, to the process of neighborhood contact requirement and also to the thresholds for which projects trigger the neighborhood contact. And this shows the difference between the current and the proposed thresholds. And as I mentioned, the proposed changes would apply the requirement to more zones and also change the threshold to a simple square footage threshold. And the second row is about land divisions. The proposal separates the threshold for land divisions from the type of review, since the number of lots created is more reflective of the impact on the surrounding community than the land use review type. And in the third row, you can see there are currently lower thresholds for some projects if they're in some areas of the city. The proposed change would remove these lower thresholds and just apply that 10,000 square foot threshold.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Development by right, is that for developments that won't require a land use
right.
review?
So okay. Where they're just meeting the zoning code requirements straightforwardly.
So they'll still have to do a sign and a meeting?
Yeah. Well, they have to do a sign for 10,000 square feet and a meeting for 25,000 square feet.
A meeting for 25. And, mm-hmm. I mean, if they're working completely within all the restrictions of their zoning, why would they have to have a meeting?
The idea in the original, the current neighborhood contact requirement that we're sort of moving forward is basically saying these meetings are valuable in order to provide people with information about what's coming, what's changing in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. After the last 10 years, a lot of people really would like an earlier heads up about things changing. Mm-hmm. And it also does create an opportunity to have a conversation between the applicant and the neighborhood, which is really valuable not only for potentially making changes to the outcomes if the developer is responsive to that, but also to creating a relationship for the kinds of issues that come up during the construction process. So we believe there's value in that information sharing and in that opportunity, in spite of the fact that there isn't necessarily a way to change the project. And we feel like the value of that outweighs the potential frustration of getting a heads up about something that you can't necessarily affect. But it's definitely something that's come up.
Is there any requirement? I mean, my concern is that community members that come to these meetings may think this is two things. They may think this is their only opportunity to address issues they have with the development. They may also think that they can have more influence than they actually have in that meeting. So will there be anyone from the city, or will the developer be required to share basic information like the next step is land use review, and if we go forward with a project the community doesn't like, here's how you file an appeal? Or mm-hmm. is there...
That is not something that we're proposing to require. It would be very difficult to enforce.
Yeah.
It's definitely something we're including in the draft sort of supporting material that BDS mm-hmm. can provide. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for education and outreach around educating the general public and also developers about land use review questions, but it's not written into this.
Okay. Thanks.
I have a question about this slide, too, about the what's the current versus the proposed in which ones are related for design review.
Mm-hmm.
What if the design district has more restrictive requirements than this new proposal? That what we were told in written testimony was division, whether the division vision requires the meeting at a lower threshold. Would that still prevail?
I don't know of any plan district that has notification requirements as part of the actual plan district.
One of the architects of Division Vision is here, so I'm sure we'll hear more
about
that.
Okay, so the Division Design Initiatives. Yeah, so that's an idea. Oh, the Division Main Street.
Yeah, so if there's a plan district that requires greater level of notification, would that plan district prevail?
My understanding is with this proposal, we've made that all uniform. What triggers this requirement?
But that's different from other zoning code where the plan district requirements, if more restrictive, are the ones that prevail.
So the division, there was a trigger for neighborhood contact that was removed with the comprehensive plan adoption in May. So that trigger that was in effect is removed because it was replaced by the mixed-use zones, which didn't have any trigger for neighborhood contact in the past. Now anything over 5 units or 10,000 square feet, as it says on here, triggers that requirement.
So there's no contact at this required?
For the division, on division, no.
Well, currently, if there's a mixed-use project in the mixed-use zones on division, it would be subject to the citywide standard for neighborhood contact in the same way that everything else would be.
Thank you.
Okay. So because these thresholds, these are the, you have heard testimony, you will hear more testimony about where these thresholds should be. We just feel like it's useful to quickly look at what these look like in the built environment and just give some examples. So projects under 10,000 square feet that would require no neighborhood contact at all under the proposal. This is R1 zoned property, building 6 units, and this did go through a type 2 review. so a land use review process. This is in commercial mixed use.
So then, just to interrupt you, mm-hmm. if it's going to have a land use review, there's mm-hmm. posting requirements for that too,
yes.
right?
Yes, and that's totally separate. That remains the same.
So yeah. those would remain the same contact, you know, who gets notified, what the mm-hmm. size of the sign is, all those kinds of things, that yeah. all stays the same?
Yeah, and that is an opportunity to actually testify or to make official comment to the city, to a decision maker. So that remains the same. This is completely separated from
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but that doesn't make much sense that there would be bigger sign and more posting for something where people, as Commissioner Udaly said, don't have much input.
We've worked with BDS to talk about how this process and how the design of the sign could be carried forward over those subsequent stages in the process. And at this stage, that's more work to do to align all the different instances that they require a sign, but that's one possible path, is for us to look at those land use reviews as a next step. And you know, the idea of the sign is that there's that box where you can post the information about a specific meeting, so it's possible that that later land use review notice could just be attached to the same sign.
Well, Carlos, you might want to think about delaying this project. I mean, I know a lot of work's gone into it, but to have a 5-foot by 4-foot sign for a meeting where there's no great ability to influence the decision, and then have one of the small monitor sizes for somewhere where you actually do get to show up and make a change, that is going to give that's going to get neighbors who are not land use geeks confused.
The details of the sign construction is something that is in the BDS administrative rules, not in the zoning code, so there's nothing precluding us from continuing to work on that with or without this code amendment.
Okay.
And then this last project is in RH, high density residential, and this project is 15 units on a 5,000 square foot lot. They did have a meeting with the neighborhood association under the current rules.
But they won't in the future?
Under this proposal, they would not require a sign or a meeting. So projects that would require a sign but no meeting would be, this is in commercial mixed use, a 5,000 square foot lot, a 12-unit apartment building. And this is a high-density residential zoned property with 10,000 square foot lot. And this is 21 units in commercial mixed use. That's a 6,800 square foot lot. So projects that would require a sign and a meeting that are over that 25,000 square foot threshold. This is 22 units in R2. Oops, got enthusiastic there. This is commercial mixed use, 75 units, and this last one is 113 units in R1. So we've had a lot of interest from stakeholders, including the Bureau of Development Services, in knowing how these proposals would affect the number of projects that trigger the neighborhood contact requirements. There are a couple parts of it that would increase the number. We're expanding to more zones, including single dwelling and EX, that are currently not included. And it would also remove the exemption for projects with a previous land use review, and this is a significant number of projects. The things that reduce the number of projects are the removal of the design-related thresholds, and also the changing the land division threshold from being associated with what type of land use review it's going through to the number of lots that are created reduces the number of land divisions that would trigger the neighborhood contact. And then also setting the threshold at 10,000 square feet regardless of number of units also decreases the number of projects that trigger this. So based on development numbers for the last 5 years, we estimate about 80 projects a year would have to meet the neighborhood contact requirements. But this is based on numbers for the last 5 years, numbers that are way down now. So we can't estimate necessarily how many projects going forward would be affected. There will be more projects. We estimate 5 to 10 additional projects a year that will trigger the neighborhood contact, but they will be a different set of projects. For example, land divisions will trigger neighborhood contact about a third less frequently than they do now. And one thing I do want to note is that even though the number of projects that are triggering the threshold is not that much higher, this will involve more work for both applicants and the Bureau of Development Services staff. Currently, the applicant may not have to do anything more than just write a letter and not receive a reply. The proposal would require the applicant at a minimum to send the notification and post a sign, and then hosting or attending a meeting for larger projects. So key issues raised in testimony at the Planning and Sustainability Commission stage that were consistent through this stage as well. Different testifiers would like to see the thresholds for the sign or the meeting requirements shifted up or down. And we also heard concern that meetings should have more restrictions around location and timing. And I also just want to float that we heard a lot of comments and testimony about the need for easier access to information about land use that goes well beyond the scope of this project, but that was a strong theme of what we heard in this project. So just to circle back around and revisit the goals of the project, the proposed changes would broaden the reach of the notice by requiring an on-site sign that can be seen by anybody passing the site in a public meeting, and increase consistency and predictability of the process and the thresholds. The process, we're making the developer always responsible for making sure the notice and the meeting do happen and the timeline is more consistent. So, and more projects will have to meet the requirements because it will be applied consistently and require the same activities regardless of whether or not there's an active neighborhood
association. Could you remind us, just again, go back to one slide. So if the developer drops the ball and doesn't give the notice and doesn't hold the meeting,
mm-hmm.
and then goes to seek a building permit or whatever, what's the consequence?
It can't be received unless they've met the requirement.
So they have to go back to the beginning of the process.
Yeah. And that's where that question about enforceability in the requirement is tricky, because it's difficult to, that's the only enforcement mechanism, is to not receive the application.
And what's the mechanism that would allow, once this is filed, the recipient of the email to come in and argue that it was sent to the wrong address, and or for the community to come and say the meeting was a sham or was scheduled in such a way to, it was scheduled in an inaccessible place at a time that unlikely people could get to, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. What's the mechanism for policing that?
So that happens now pretty frequently, that a neighborhood association will say, we didn't get the letter, or they said they lied when they said they had a meeting. We didn't actually have a meeting. It's kind of the staff have to arbitrate and make a decision, and they can put like an administrative hold on the project if they see a convincing case. Yeah.
Well, the numbers that you've put up earlier that would be covered by this, and that assumes the economy continues to hum along, and what we're seeing is, you know, obviously a decline.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like the numbers are so big that we couldn't get, you know, in the first year or two, a report back on how this is working.
Mm-hmm.
We could fine tune it if necessary. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Just going on, continuing on the numbers, we received testimony from Matt V. Rezanov with Arbor Lodge, who mm-hmm. says that only 66% of the projects that currently had neighborhood contacts would have been 66 would have been exempted, and 100% of the permitted projects required to meet in permits mm-hmm. in person would now be exempted.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that jive with that there'll be 5 to 10 more?
So I haven't gone back and like looked at every permit from Arbor Lodge in response to that testimony, but because of the unit, the change from to square footage instead of units, like things that are building, like that apartment building 15 units that's smaller than 10,000 square feet, that's the category where that development is falling into.
And what was the rationale for choosing 10,000 square feet?
We wanted to have, so 10,000 square feet is a threshold that's there a lot in the zoning code, and we had to pick something that was measurable and also tied directly to the impact of the building on the community. And the size of the building is something that we hear a lot about, and square footage is easy to measure. So 10,000 was a good threshold that kind of cuts out most single-dwelling development, because we didn't want to kind of get into triggering single-dwelling projects having neighborhood contact.
What was the rationale for the previous thought of doing it by unit?
That, you know, I think that the way the neighborhood contact has been, the thresholds have been applied, and in the slide it showed all of the different ways. It's been kind of applied piecemeal in response to various projects. And what we wanted to do was not be piecemeal, but be holistic and consistent across the city.
Thank you.
So I just want to wrap it up with next steps. The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is developing an online notification tool to fulfill the online contact element. And we will be piloting this tool and then handing it over to the Bureau of Development Services, which is working with the Bureau of Technology Services on the Portland Online Permitting System that will move the city's paper-based development review process to an online system. And this tool can be integrated into that work in the future. The effective date is set in the ordinance for December 2019 to allow for outreach time and also for that integration of the online notification with the POP system. But because this requirement is a process step that has to be met before the application can be submitted, we want to make sure that there's time to do a good job of letting applicants know that it's coming down the pike so they won't be surprised. And that's all I've got. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Any further questions? Thank you. Commissioner Fritz, I understand you have an amendment.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fish has a question.
No, I'm fine. We're going to hear from Chris Smith, right?
We're going to hear from Chris Smith after we hear from
Planning Sustainability
Commissioner Fritz.
Well, first, thank you, Ms. Wright, for all of your work on this project and your extensive outreach. I've been really impressed. And it's interesting we're having the hearing on a Wednesday afternoon when maybe people can't come, but even so, the volume of emails, et cetera, that I've had has been testimony to the fact that you have been able to create a lot of consensus, so I appreciate that. I actually have two amendments, which I didn't put one of them down, but anyway, the one that I've handed out here, this is on the location of the meeting place. And since currently the meeting happens with the Neighborhood Association, who is required by city policy to be accessible and provide to do their meetings in places that are accessible, I wanted to make sure that that these meetings were in accessible places too. And so the changes to after number D, after under the section 33705020B4D about the meeting, that it be open to the public and be in a location that provides equitable access to all members of the public. Accessibility includes providing language services, removing barriers, providing modifications, accommodations, alternative formats, auxiliary aids, or other services that ensure access, all of those on request. So the meeting location itself has to be a place that people using mobility devices can get into without having to ask that. The other services, including language translation, et cetera, would be on request. So that's my first amendment.
I'll second that.
Thank you. And then the second amendment is under C. We received testimony from the Sullivan's Gulch Neighborhood Association suggesting that having the mandatory, the timing currently says be held at a time between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. Monday through Friday, or between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Saturday or Sunday. Sullivan's Gulch pointed out that religious services are often held on Saturday and Sunday mornings. And I know from my experience as a parent of a family of sports enthusiasts that youth sports are often held on in the morning too. So I would suggest that get changed as requested by Sullivan's Gulch, that the Saturday or Sunday meetings be between 1 p.m. and 6 p.m.
I'll second that for discussion purposes. I have a couple of questions about that.
Thank you.
Conceptually.
So those are now on the table, and we can continue. Thank you.
Good. Could I just ask staff a couple of questions about those particular amendments? The first one strikes me as eminently sensible in terms of accessibility. Is there any reason why we should not be supportive of that amendment? Does legal counsel have any concerns
I can actually answer that. there are some concerns about enforceability, again, and I think as a practical matter, again, it would be a judgment call by the staff if it was said that it was held in a fortress that nobody could get into.
It would be very difficult for the Bureau of Development Services staff when given, you know, the evidence that the requirement was met to make a decision about whether it was accessible or not. So it is a question of enforceability.
I could see also the request for other services. I mean, certainly important where there's a need. I could also see that could be abused in terms of a developer receiving multiple requests. And since this happens prior to the permitting, there'd be no real city involvement in that.
So let me ask the question slightly differently. As an aspiration, this seems important. I mean, we've had other conversations with the disability community in front of this
in this council. And acknowledging that we are arm's length from this transaction.
I just want to note that I did grapple with this quite a bit in development of this, and I reached out to the Commission on Disability for some feedback about, and also Alan De La Torre with the Institute for Aging, just to get some feedback about what kinds of things would be sort of baseline needs. And that information is included in the supporting documentation that's sort of providing education to the developers and recommendations for finding a location, that kind of thing. But we just felt, because of the enforceability question, to keep it out of the code language at this time.
I do agree, and I appreciate it having it in the supplementary, but the neighborhood's not going to have that supplementary material. And as we just discussed, none of this is really enforceable. So having, as the mayor said, an aspirational statement of value in the code, I think, is an important thing.
Well, Commissioner Fish.
Let's take this question about enforceability, because it seems to me that if someone were to argue that they were prevented from participating because of the absence of a language service, that could cause BDS to put an administrative hold on it to determine whether it was actually an equitable meeting, right? It is a basis for preventing further action until you've investigated.
Potentially, and BDS would have to grapple with how to make that determination, but yeah.
And that's part of the challenge of moving the onus to the applicant. Under the current system, the complaint would be to the Neighborhood Association that the Neighborhood Association didn't provide those services.
Well, the way it's worded, and I was sort of musing at the placement of the comma, but I agree with the placement of the comma. It's upon request, and so it makes it easier to determine whether or not, in fact, somebody had made the request, and if they made the request, what happened to that request. And so while I understand that enforcement is always an issue with many things we do here at the City of the Portland, that at least puts brackets around it.
I have a question for the city attorney.
Commissioner Udaly.
It seems like we're getting into kind of a nebulous zone, but in my mind it should be very clear. If we are requiring a developer to hold a meeting as part of a prescribed process to get to the land use review, we should have very clear standards for accessibility, and physical accessibility would be the most basic. I don't personally know if we have the legal right to require ASL interpretation or language support, but it seems like something we should be very clear about, or we should get clear about.
Well, let me ask this, because it sounds like conceptually there's at least a consensus here that this is a worthy objective. Is there a way we could, rather than locking ourselves into the language today, is there a way that we could have this be a critical component that we take a little time to think about and bring back? And I'll ask that of Commissioner Fritz, since it's her amendment. I support the context of the amendment. I think it's an important point.
I mean, It's a non-emergency ordinance, so at the very least we have another week. So that's one good thing. We are being asked to adopt the code, and the code says a lot of things about where the location of the meeting is that will have some enforceability. As I say, it's a challenge, because with neighborhood associations, they have to conform to the standards that we set, and we can require that on request these services be provided, and that they have their meetings in locations that are automatically accessible to people who use mobility devices.
Because the effective date was set out fairly far in advance, and there's no immediate deadline pushing us to adopt it, we did not assume you were going to adopt or move to second reading today. So if you had the hearing and then brought back language at the next meeting before it was forwarded to second reading, that's fine.
That would be helpful. Commissioner Fish.
I like the idea of sharpening the language, conferring with legal counsel to make sure that it's within our authority and it's enforceable, because we don't want to put something in here that turns out to be neither. The one friendly amendment I would offer is, after requests, where it says upon request, upon request prior to the meeting.
Yes.
I know that's your intent, but I would just offer that as a friendly amendment.
In fact, probably 3 days prior to the meeting.
So that there's a reasonable period of time for the to put these in place.
So, okay. Yeah, so could I suggest this from a procedural perspective? It sounds like we're giving head nods. Can I keep this amendment open for the second reading, or what's your preference?
Yeah, except as a friendly amendment, adding upon request 3 days prior to the meeting. Let's take testimony to see what people have to say, and then yes, sir.
Good. And then I had a question of legal counsel pertaining to Commissioner Fritz's second amendment. Her second amendment was to change the time of day to Sunday afternoons from 1 to 6 p.m. Is there any specific issue there that this flags from your perspective?
I think I heard Saturday and Sunday.
Saturday
1
and
PM,
Sunday,
and,
correct.
And I am not, it's not, that's not raising any specific legal concerns that I have in mind.
Does this raise any operational questions from your perspective?
No. Does the current meeting, do we currently have the same rules that apply to neighborhood associations with these timeframes?
I don't actually know the parameters about the rules
that
are the neighborhood association meeting timing.
But as a practical matter, they try to choose times that people can get to. I mean, the proposal is to have it between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Saturday or Sunday. So narrowing that, I don't see why that would be a problem.
And just to be clear, the intent is because people's schedules are busy Saturday and Sunday morning, and
correct.
So they're more inclined to be available in the afternoon to attend, so it will be open to a broader pool of people.
Thank you. That was what I should have said.
Perfectly said. Thank you. Good. Okay. Thank you.
Good.
Mr. Smith, you're up. Thank you for your patience. Welcome. And Chris Smith is here, obviously, representing the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Thank you.
Mayor, Commissioners, good afternoon. I am Chris Smith, Vice Chair of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, representing the Commission's recommendation. We do urge you to adopt this recommendation. There are 3 points I'd like to make from our discussion. The first is we heard testimony about the 10,000 square foot and 25,000 square foot thresholds, as Sarah said, in both directions, that they were either too high or too low. We looked at the bucket frequency of what size of projects the city sees over a given period of time and concluded there really weren't other values for those that made any more sense than these do, so we did not change that aspect of it. We did have a dissenting vote on this proposal that came from our chair, and her concern was that this is potentially one more hurdle to development, but also I think more specifically the concern that Commissioner Udaly raised, which is that people may equate the opportunity to engage with an assumption there is some kind of discretionary review going on. We talked about whether that could be indicated on the sign. The challenge is that at the time the sign is posted, you may not know the exact review process the project will go through because, if you design in something that requires an adjustment, that may change down the road as you go through the application process, so we really can't communicate that in advance. Nonetheless, the commission as a whole felt that the value of community engagement early outweighed those concerns and did support the proposal. The third point I want to make is about the online access. When this proposal came to us, it did not contain online access as one of the components of the project. We were very concerned that that was a fundamentally ableist approach. In order to benefit from this, without online access, you would have to be able to physically convey yourself to the site. You'd have to have sufficient visual ability to read the sign, and as the mayor pointed out, you'd have to be able to read written English. By adding the online component, of course, you get access to tools like screen readers. You can view it from anywhere, and worst case, you can run through Google Translate and try and get an approximation in your language. So we felt that was essential to move this forward. We did hear from both BDS and BTS about the challenges with timing with POPs. I think that's in part why this has a long lead time to try and sync up those opportunities, but we did feel that online access was an essential component.
Thank you, Chris.
Excellent.
That makes me feel better.
Commissioner Smith, I was just extolling your virtues yesterday to the mayor because you explained to me about the RSS feed and the ability to sign up to get notifications when websites changes. So it seems like if we could just get the platform so that the developers could then post to it, people could sign up and or unsign up as they wished.
Yeah, the minimum threshold for subscribability is pretty low if you use RSS as the technology.
So I also want to just be fully transparent. Thank you to Commissioner Fritz, and thank you one arm's length removed, Chris, because I've already used it in a conversation, and it made me sound really smart, so I appreciate that. So thank you for that. I'm wondering if you had any further thoughts on either of the amendments that have been proposed.
I think we balanced the meeting requirements. We did add, I think we tilted a little more towards involvement of the neighborhood association. I don't see either of the amendments being incompatible with the parameters we discussed.
Great. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks again for your service. Carla, do we have people signed up for public testimony?
Yes, we have six people.
Very good.
The first three are Rocky Johnson, Linda Nedekoven, and Doug Klotz.
All right. Come on down. Name for the record, please. 3 minutes each. And if the microphones are about 6 inches away from your mouth, that tends to be just about right. And please just leave the microphones on when you're done.
Great.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Rocky Johnson. I am a member of the Land Use Committee for the Selwyn-Moreland Neighborhood Association. And the concern that we have is relaxing the requirement for neighborhood contact meetings from 10,000 to 25,000 square foot. We have a lot of projects in the 10,000 to 25,000 square foot range that are currently happening in our neighborhood, and we've had pretty effective meetings with developers in situations where we've been able to save trees, we've been able to improve landscaping, we've been able to improve the exterior building quality, we've been able to improve transportation flows and safety concerns. And so we're concerned that if you you raise that threshold to 25,000 square foot, we're going to lose that opportunity. And it's going to damage the livability of our neighborhood for years to come. So I just want to emphasize that as a major concern that we have in Selwyn-Moreland neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Commissioner Fritz.
If you look at the notice at 10,000 square foot, do you think that developers have learned that your group can help improve a project, and that if you were then to invite them to a neighborhood meeting, it doesn't say that they can't get invited to a neighborhood meeting. It just means that you wouldn't be their sole venue. Would that work?
We just want to make sure that they have the requirement to have the neighborhood contact meeting.
Okay.
Because without that, our experiences are not as prone to do that. And some are more happy to do that than others. But in most cases, we have a fairly productive exchange. And it actually benefits them because it makes their projects more marketable in the long run. So I think it's a good relationship, and it's a good planning tool. So I don't want you to see you dispense with a good planning tool for the city of Portland. It's not a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and council members. My name is Linda Nedekoven. I live in the Hosford-Abernathy neighborhood, but I'm speaking only for myself this afternoon. And so I don't forget, I want to call out the good work that Sarah has done. I'm one of those people that has talked with her, bothered her multiple times, and I'm aware of the myriad of people that she's talked to in this process. So I really appreciate that effort. This piece of code is really critical, as my esteemed colleague from Selwood just mentioned, in giving neighbors and business owners and employees an opportunity to really help shape the growth and change coming to the places where they live and work. And this issue of being able to have the conversation is oftentimes about the design, and that's interior surrounding as well as not just the aesthetics of the building. Oftentimes it leads to a much better project and less animosity and frustration and resentment about growth and change. So that's why we think it's really critical to have these conversations and to have them done well. And I want to first mention that I support the effort and the project, and I share the widely held notion that the sign is a great innovation, and I think, again, needs to be explored for the work of other bureaus as well, some kind of consistent signage of the same shape and sign and color with similar information might be really useful for us. I have a couple of major concerns, though, or they may be minor. The informational letters that go to just the neighborhood association, business association, et cetera,
Our Safeway store sat at the 27th and Hawthorne, the junction of four neighborhood associations. So I know some of the land use review code specifies within a certain radius of a project you have to notify people. So to just fine-tune that so it, you know, the note, the informational letters go a bit further out, because if you're a few blocks away as a neighborhood association or another business district, you might still want to know about it. The other is the bigger issue, which is the trigger for community meetings that Selwood has just mentioned. And, you know, I would ask for either 10,000 square feet or four stories, however that could be defined. I can, first of all, point to New Seasons at 40th and Hawthorne, which comes in at 17,000 square feet, less than 17,000 square feet. So it would not have merited a meeting. So at a minimum, we need to be looking at some use categories, perhaps, or some other issue in terms of where we set that threshold. But as I said, I would prefer that there just be a lower threshold back to what we've had before. It's the four-story buildings that are, you know, sort of really changing the character and also creating a lot of the resentment among some quarters in our community. And this is such a tremendous opportunity when meetings are run well. And we have a lot of suggestions about that. Sarah's incorporated many of them in the information that she has. Can I say just one last thing?
Go ahead, sure.
Which is that in 2006, the council did adopt our Green Street Main Street plan, which called for any new development on the street to merit a meeting. And as you can see, that has not slowed down development on Division in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, I think that, and I understand we need to look at staff workload, et cetera, but this, the wins and loses in terms of the community meetings can be great. And the more effort we put into the way BDS alerts people to resources and the way coalitions and neighborhoods work with people on these meetings, the better they can be for all of us.
Thanks, Linda. Thank you. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Hi, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is Doug Klotz. I support this proposal. The current process does not work very well, as we heard. And I think the 4-foot by 5-foot sign is a great improvement. I've seen that in other cities, and this will help a lot of questions that I used to get when I was land use chair of the Richmond neighborhood. Also, my experience, though, at the Richmond neighborhood is perhaps not as positive as Linda's. a lot of meetings consist of people coming and you know, complaining about the project, and it was known that there was no requirement for the developer to change anything. So that's why I support the thresholds as they sit, because the 10,000 square feet, the projects under that, the bigger projects that are under that may very well go through design review and other things anyway. But the smaller projects, the sign will tell folks what's going to happen, and they won't have the ability to change. So it's, rather than setting up expectations that they can go to a meeting and affect some change, just leaving the 10,000 square foot to 10,000 to 25 foot at just the large sign and the notice to neighbor associations seems fine to me. And the larger buildings will have the meetings, and probably will also have design review. So I support that. Also wanted to say that I really appreciate Sarah Wright's work on this. She's actually leaving the city coming up here, and I hope that when budget improves, she will be one of the first hired back. But she does a great job, and she's very personable and does a great job at interacting with the public. So
thank you for saying that. We appreciate it when we hear that of our employees. Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Next three, please. Carla.
Our Christian Trabal, Leah Fisher, and Heather Flint Chateau.
Good afternoon. Do you want to go ahead and start? Name for the record,
sure.
Please.
Christian Trabal, chair of the Overlook Neighborhood Association. First, let me just echo what's been said. Sarah's been great to work with on this project. All of staff has been very helpful and communicative.
Now, if you keep this up, she's going to be a front runner for the Andrew Abbey Award for exemplary public outreach, because this is very complimentary. And I have to say, listening to her original presentation on some very complicated issues, I was struck by not only how accessible she made the information, but obviously how far she went in consulting with people. So it's nice to, in these forums, to see the public compliment staff because they certainly catch a lot of the other stuff. So
I would support her receiving that award.
Thank you.
To echo what's been said already, we kind of do support a lower threshold here. If the gauge for residents to know what's happening in the neighborhood and the impacts that are going to happen on the neighborhood is just 25,000 square feet for a meeting,